As the holidays approach, many of us will be spending time with family. Sometimes we're looking forward to that, sometimes not so much. One of the things we often do when we gather as families is we tell stories. We tell stories about our family, some that are good, some that are bad, all of mix of these different stories. We each come from a different kind of family. Some with lots of stories to tell, some with not so many stories to tell, some that maybe we don't want to tell those stories. Well, today we're going to be looking at a family that if you think your family has problems, wait till you meet this one. Because they are a family filled with problems, but what we will see throughout this story is that God maintains his faithfulness to them. That God uses this family that is filled with liars and deceivers and tricksters, and still uses them to bless the world. So in today's message, we're going to be looking at part of, we've been going through a study called Immerse, which is a look through the first five books of the Old Testament, kind of reading big sections of it. And so today we're going to be looking at a part of that. And one of the things we're doing is we're realizing when we come to the Old Testament is that it can be hard to study the Old Testament. I like what Dr. Sandra Richter says when she talks about it. She says, many of us, when we come to the Old Testament, experience what she calls dysfunctional closet syndrome. Now, I might be alone in this, but I have these closets, these junk drawers, these boxes out in the garage where there's a lot of stuff in them, and I know there's stuff in them, but it's not always easy to find. Maybe you have a drawer like that. Maybe you have a closet like that. Maybe there's that box of leftover crafts that has all those different things in it, or the box with all the nuts and bolts and screws or pieces of wood that you're going to use at some point. And they're in there, but it's not very organized. You struggle to find it, and oftentimes you just grab what's on the top. And Sandra Richter says, the Old Testament is a lot like that for many of us. It's just that there's a lot of names, there's a lot of places, a lot of people, a lot of stories, but they're just kind of in this big pile and we don't know what to do with it. And so sometimes we just go to the top and we just pull what's off the top and they're those familiar stories. But what I want to do today is, one, give a little way to help us think about how can we bring a little bit of order to the Old Testament? How can we begin to like maybe find some smaller bins, some ways to group and to organize? And there's lots of different ways to do that with our Old Testament. Many ways to describe the story. But I want to borrow a phrase that's kind of a combination of a phrase from two scholars. And they said this: when we think about the story of the Bible, that it's God's intent, is God's people living in God's place, under God's rule, with full access to God's presence. And that's kind of the story of the Bible as we look through it. And it's on the first pages of the Bible. We see God creating a world that's good, and people are in God's presence. That's the first two pages of the Bible. And then we turn to the very end of the Bible, and we hear this, and this is Revelation, last two pages of the Bible. I heard a loud shout from the throne saying, look, God's home is now among his people. He will live with them and they will be his people. God himself will be with them. So we have God's people living in God's presence, under God's rule, with full access to his presence. And so there it is. But then we say, wait a minute, that's the first two pages of the Bible and the last two pages of the Bible. If you look at your Bible, there's a whole lot more pages, aren't there? And so what happens in between there? Well, what happens in between there is people break the plan. And God goes about to redeem that plan. And so we use a word called redemption. And again, I like what Richter says when she describes redemption as one of those words that's kind of biblish. And she says, biblish is a word that comes from the Bible in English, but has been so overused by the Christian community that it becomes gibberish. And so redemption is a way that a family's restored, a lost family member restored, that things are returned to the way they're intended to be. So that's the story of the Bible. It starts off as this good place with people living in God's presence, and people choose their own way. It's broken, and the rest of the story of the Bible is God redeeming, God fixing all that mess and bringing it back to the final conclusion of where it was. So today I want to offer just a way to kind of organize the story of the Bible, in particular the Old Testament. And there's lots of different ways to do it. But two helpful ways to think about it are by kind of time and space. And so time, we think of timelines, and we're not going to do a big, long timeline because sometimes that's the temptation. If you tried to draw a timeline of the Old Testament, it would stretch from that wall to that wall with all the different events. And maybe you've tried to do that before. Maybe you haven't. Another way to think about it is geography, because that's everyone's favorite thing. We're not going to do any geography today. We'll do that in some future things, but a timeline. But I want to give you a really simple timeline to think about the story of the Bible. A very simple thing. We're just going to look at a little part of it today, not going to go into great detail in this timeline, but I'll refer back to it now and then as just a big way to organize the story of the Bible, a way to take that dysfunctional closet of the Old Testament and begin to find some little hooks, some little bins to put everything in so you get a story, an idea of like, here's where the story goes. And this I'm borrowing from another scholar, Dr. Kathy Kaminsky, and she uses the phrase casket empty. It's an acronym, and so this is what it is. And so she says it's this. It's casket empty, so creation, Abraham, Sinai, Kings, Exile, Temple. That's the Old Testament. That's the story of the Old Testament, six words. We can remember six words, right? Creation, Abraham, Sinai, Kings, Exile, Temple. Then, guess what? The New Testament, empty. Expectation, Messiah, Pentecost, telling and yearning. I'm not going to explain what all those, but you can begin to see there's a way to begin to organize it. So if we just think about our Old Testament, it begins with creation, and then Abraham, who we're going to read about today. Sinai is Moses and the stories about him. We'll get into those in the next few weeks. Kings, Exile, and Temple, we're not going to do in this series, but it gives you a bucket to begin to think about. As I'm reading the Old Testament, what's the big story of the old thing? And if you notice the way it goes together, casket empty, which is a play on an empty tomb, which tells us that the story is about Jesus. And Jesus is at the center of the story. And so it's a great way to play it. So we're going to begin with this key idea that God is faithful and will bring blessings. So we begin with the first letter was C, which creation, right? So that was last week. We talked about God created a good world. So the opening page of the Bible, God creates a good world, puts people into it, but people choose their own way. And the first 11 chapters of the Bible are time and time again, people choosing their way over God's way. But God remains faithful. And one of the things that God does in the midst of that is he makes a promise to the first two people, to Adam and Eve, that he's going to redeem them, that he's going to fix things. And he's going to do it through a family line. And so in Genesis 3:15, he says, "And I will cause hostility between you," that's he's talking to the serpent, "and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring." So there's going to be a family battle. "He will strike your head and you will strike his heel." So the point is, there's going to be some sense of a family coming down from those first people. God is going to use a family line to bring about the redemption. And so this family line becomes important. So one of those struggles in the Old Testament is when you're reading through the Old Testament, particularly in Genesis, sometimes you come across genealogies. I know some of you enjoy making family trees and tracing back your ancestry and figuring out what country you came from and all the different facts of it. But I'll be honest, my guess is most of us, when we come to the genealogies in the Bible, what do? Skip ahead, right? You start reading those and you're like, what in the world is going on? When you get to a part when Seth was 105 years old and became the father of Enosh, after the birth of Enosh, Seth lived another 870 years. And he had other sons and daughters. Seth lived 912 years and then he died. When Enosh was, you're like, okay, next page, please, right? But the genealogies are important. Now, you don't need to memorize the genealogies. If a name's important, you'll figure it out. But the genealogies serve important functions in the story. One of the things that genealogies do is they serve as a transition. But they also help us follow the story. So, for example, in what we call Genesis 5, and I'm using chapters and verses. I know our immersed don't have that. But in what we call Genesis chapter 5, there's a genealogy that takes her from Adam to his son Seth down to Noah. So it begins to connect this story, and we come to Noah. Noah is the one who experiences the flood. And then we have Adam to Noah, and then after the flood, in what we call chapter 11, there's another genealogy. And in the midst of that genealogy, we meet a son of Noah named Shem. And then we go on, he talks about the other ones, and there's a little bit of Shem's line. But then what happens is that it comes back to Shem later on in chapter 11. And so we get this strange thing that's going on. It's like, well, there's the genealogy. It kind of cuts off and then it comes again. Again, don't remember all the names. The important names are repeated. So we get this little thing at the end of chapter 11. And we hear about Shem's family, and he has a, at the end of it, it talks about a man named Terah and his son Abraham, Nabor, and Haran. And then we jump in and we learn more about Terah. Again, we don't need to know all the details. Short story, Terah has three sons. One dies. One is married, doesn't have any kids. They go to set off on a journey to another land. They only make it halfway. They stop there. And Terah dies. And so if we've been reading this, we've had this genealogy. And what's the point of the genealogy? Remember, back Genesis, God says there's going to be a family line that's he's going to use to redeem the world. Well, right at this point in the story, doesn't sound like that family line's doing very well. You got one son who doesn't have any kids. Dad's dead. They didn't even make it where they're going to. And so they're stranded in the middle of the nowhere. And so we're thinking, this is the line of promise. This is what God is going to do. Doesn't sound very promising, does it? Well, not from a human perspective. But we ask, how will God carry out his plan? How will he restore the world? Well, what God does is he picks one of those people. So we've gone from this giant story about the whole world and a flood of the whole world down to just Noah. And now we're down to one man in his family, a man named Abram. Or later, name changed to Abraham, which is our second letter. Remember, casket, creation, Abraham. And so he's a significant thing. So we get the part that Mike read from Genesis 12, 1 through 3. And where it just says, leave your country, your native country. I'm going to read this and I want to say, pay attention to if you notice any key words. Leave your native country, your relatives and your father's family, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you and make you famous, and you will be a blessing to others. I will bless those who bless you, and curse those who curse you and treat you with contempt. All the families on earth will be blessed through you. Anything you notice about that that stands out to you? Blessing, right? And who's doing everything in that? God is, right? I will make you. I will give you. I will bless. And so there's this story that's happening. So God comes to this man named Abram. We read, he's 75 years old. He's married, doesn't have any kids. And God says to him, I'm going to make you into a great nation. Well, what do you need for a nation? You need land and a people, right? He's got neither of those at this point. Remember, he didn't even make it to where he was supposed to go. He's living in tents in the middle of nowhere. He's 75, no kids at this point. So things aren't looking real good for that part of the story. We're thinking, what in the world is going on? How's he going to be a great nation? And so we're looking at what we read the stories. We see there's an obstacle. God has made this promise to Abram now. You're going to be a great nation. And what we see is a theme we'll talk a lot about today is there are obstacles to God's promise. These things that seem to get in the way. Some obstacles are poor choices from God's people. Other things get in the way. But what we see is the obstacles don't stop God. So one is Abram's got no kids, right? We're going to come back to that one. Other challenge. Nation needs land. Well, they don't have any land, but God takes him there. So Genesis 12, 6. Abram traveled through the land as far as Shechem. There he set up camp beside the oak of Moreh. At that time, the area was inhabited by Canaanites. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and I said, I will give you this land to your descendants. And Abram built an altar there and dedicated it to the Lord who had appeared to him. Well, so now we're getting closer, right? Great nation needs land. He goes and he finds a land, but there's a problem with the land. What's the problem with the land? There's other people living there. I mean, if I said to you, I'm going to give you a house, and I took you down the street and said, there's your house, and there's people living there, you might think, well, that's not very helpful. What are you going to do with the people who are living there? That's going to come later in the story. So, problem still, right? No kids, land is occupied. And reminder, Abram's 75 years old and his wife's probably about similar age. So chance of kids, pretty slim, right? All right, so we're going to look at three challenges today. Three ways the obstacle. So we're setting up this story. Abram is going to be this vehicle, this line through which God does his amazing things. But they're going to have problems. First one comes pretty quick, Genesis 12:10. At that time, so this is right after God has spoken to Abram and told him he's going to make him into a great nation. A severe famine struck the land of Canaan, forcing Abram to go down to Egypt where he lived as a foreigner. All right. So he's standing on the edge of the land. There's foreigners, there's Canaanites living there. Now he's in Egypt. Is he getting any closer to possessing a land? Any closer to? Nope, not at all. Okay, it gets worse though. Here's where the stories in the Bible get crazy. So Abram and his wife Sarai, they go down to Egypt. And Abram's thinking about his wife, and like all husbands, thinks his wife is very attractive and thinks, well, they're going to want her. So we got to come up with a plan, Sarai. So here's their plan. Tell them you're my sister. Seems like a reasonable plan, right? What's going on with that? What could go wrong? So they come down, they tell Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, well, this is my sister. Pharaoh says, good, she can be my wife then. And he begins to take Sarah as his wife, Sarai as his wife. He gives Abram all kinds of animals and servants and stuff. And then all of a sudden, Pharaoh's inflicted with all these wounds and sickness. He said, what's going on here? And God says, well, you're taking this man's wife as your wife. Well, Pharaoh's like, Abram, why didn't you tell me this? And then he's like, so what does Pharaoh do? He says, get out of here. Sends him out of Egypt. But Abram leaves with a lot more than he came, which leaves us a little bit confused, right? So was this a good thing? I mean, it seems like a good thing. He went down there. He lied about his wife being his sister. And he ends up with animals and servants. And he's out of Egypt. A little bit confused, probably. It gets more confusing. Because if we flip the pages a few more to page 20 or chapter 20, there's a similar story. A lot has happened, but once again, Abraham and Sarah go. They're with a foreign king. And guess what Abraham tells the foreign king about Sarah? It's my sister. So what does the king do? Well, I'm going to make her my wife. And this time the foreign king has a dream from God, says, don't do that. Guess what he does? He gives Abraham a bunch of animals and servants and sends him on his way. What kind of story is that? It gets better. Chapter 26. Abraham has had a son named Isaac. He goes and he meets some foreigners. And he has his wife Rebecca with him. Guess what he tells the foreigners? It's my sister. Maybe he learned it from dad. Maybe he's growing up with dad, and dad's like, I tell you what, Isaac, if you're ever in a foreign land and people looking at your wife, tell them she's your sister because it works out really well. And it does. Isaac ends up with all kinds of crops, ends up with all kinds of wealth. And so as we're reading this, we might be asking ourselves the question, is that the moral of the story? Am I supposed to look at Abraham and Isaac and say, I should do like that? So next time I go to a foreign country, next time you take a trip to Mexico and you're in the town, don't tell them she's your wife. Say, this is my sister. And maybe you'll come back rich. If we were to read the Bible at a simple level, we might think, well, that's what it's saying. That's not what it's saying, okay? Don't go home and say, this is what my pastor told me to do. But what is the story telling us? One, we notice nothing in the story says these were good choices. Never does it say, and God said, good job, Abraham. Good job, Isaac. But what we see is God overcomes a threat to the line. He's got this family, and the threat to the line is the family themselves. They keep making dumb choices. But God told Abraham what? Says, I will bless you. And in some cases, those foreign nations are also blessed. So in spite of Abraham and Isaac being liars and screwing things up again and again, God chooses to bless them and bless his people because God has made a promise. God overcomes the threat to the promise. Okay, let's consider another story. So let's go back to Abram. Abram is 75. Sarai, no kids, right? So we come 10 years later in the story to what we call chapter 15. Still no kids. So now Abraham is, let's do the math, 85, right? Abraham is 85, still no kids. God says, look up at the stars in the sky. That's how many descendants you're going to have. And Abraham's thinking, I got none. And so what's going to happen? Well, Abram and Sarah, they kind of work together, and this is what happens. I want you to pay attention to the language you use. So Sarai said to Abram, "The Lord has prevented me from having children. So go and sleep with my servant. Perhaps I can have children through her." And Abram agreed with Sarai's proposal. This seems really strange to us, a little more perhaps common back in that day. But so we're thinking, wait a minute. God promised Abram and Sarah children. So now what's Sarah doing? She's kind of taking things in her own hand. But I want you to notice the language here in 16:3. It says, "So Sarai, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian servant, and gave her to Abram as a wife." This happened 10 years after Abram had settled in the land of covenant of Canaan. So notice the language there, because I'm going to read a story that we read last week from the book of Genesis and see if you see any language that's similar. "So the woman was convinced. She saw that the tree was beautiful and its fruit looked delicious, and she wanted the wisdom it would give her. So she took some of the fruit and then she gave it to her husband who was still with her and he ate it." Do you notice any similar language? So we have Sarah who takes Hagar and gives her to Abram, and he sleeps with her. We have Eve, who takes from the fruit, gives it to her husband, and he eats it. I think there's some parallels, intention, those parallels are intentional there. In both cases, what's happening? The people are failing to trust God. They're saying, we're gonna make this work out. God's plan isn't working. I don't trust what God is doing, so let's take control. Guess what? Things don't go well when this happens. When we have Eve in the garden, they end up and they're both guilty here. We're not blaming it on the women in this particular place. They're both involved in this process here. And so what happens with Eve and Adam? They end up out of the garden. What happens with Sarah and Abraham and then Hagar? Well, Hagar has a son. There's family turmoil. And her son, Ishmael, becomes the head of the nation that's constantly at war with Israel. And so there's this bad choices that result, and we think, what is going on? What is going on with this family God chose? Because if you think of, say, sports or business world, if you have an employee, if you have a player, if you have a manager, and they continually make bad choices, and your team keeps losing, your business keeps losing money, what do? You trade them, you fire them, right? God doesn't seem to work that way. But what's interesting, this story, so we have Sarai and this story with Hagar. Guess what comes right after that story? The next passage that Mike read for us earlier, chapter 17, where God comes back to Abram and says, "I made a promise and I'm keeping it. You're going to have descendants." So even though Abram and Sarah have already had this issue with going down to Egypt and lying about her being a sister, they've already had this issue with trying to have a child through Hagar, the slave, God comes and reaffirms his promise to Abram. It says, "I will make you into a great nation. In fact, I'm going to change your name from Abram to Abraham because you're going to be the father of many nations." In spite of the obstacles, God keeps going. And that's reassuring to me because sometimes I'm impatient. Sometimes I choose poorly. Maybe sometimes you struggle to trust. You hear God's plan. You know what God wants you to do, but you're not sure if that's going to work out. You struggle to be patient. Maybe you find yourselves in situations and you're thinking, well, what's the right thing? What's the wrong thing to do? And we struggle to trust God. But God is faithful. So what can we do? We can ask God to help us. Say, "God, help me to trust you. I don't understand this situation. I know what you're calling me to do, but help me to trust you." We can pray for patience. We can pray for insight. Sometimes people find helpful journaling or finding other ways to remind themselves about God's faithfulness. To say, God was faithful that other time. Now, that's a reminder to me God is going to be faithful the next time. So we have these multiple stories that God's people are flawed, but God is faithful. That he works in spite of sometimes even using the flaws of the people. And so that's our last story for today. So quick genealogy. Abraham has a son named Isaac. And Isaac has a son named Jacob. And now Jacob has 11 sons. Well, there's actually 12 sons, one daughter, 11 sons, then one daughter and another son later. But super condensed version of this amazing story, okay? This is the last, 12, 12 plus chapters of the book of Genesis. So Jacob has 11 sons. The youngest of those sons is Joseph. Joseph is a favorite of his dad. We all know how it goes in families when there's a favorite, right? So he's a favorite. He gives him a special coat to wear. Plus, Joseph is a little bit of, could we say, maybe a brat. He's a little bit obnoxious. He kind of goes through, he has a dream one time where God says, your brothers are going to bow down to you at some point in the future. Now, if you're a little brother and you have a dream from God that says your older brothers are going to bow down to you, what do you probably not want to do? Tell your older brothers about it, right? Guess what Joseph does? Tells his older brothers. And older brothers don't like it when little brothers tell us that. So these older brothers concoct a plan. They don't do what older brothers might do, like lock him in a closet or something. These older brothers sell him into slavery, because that's what older brothers do to little brothers who are obnoxious, right? And so they sell him off into slavery, and he ends up down in Egypt. Remember our geography? So back and forth. They're down in Egypt again. He's down in Egypt now. He goes through this whole series of ups and downs. But all along that story, if you read that story from Genesis 38 and on, it says God is with him all this time. So Joseph is down there, and he's going through all these things. God is with him. And then in the story, it says there's another famine in the land, in Egypt and also up in Canaan, where Jacob and his family live. So again, once again, we have what? A threat to this promise. There's a famine in the land. So Jacob sends the rest of his sons, except for that youngest one, down to Egypt to get some food. So once again, there's the famine. They're away from the land they're supposed to be in, and they go to Egypt. They come looking for food. And guess who they get sent to get food? Joseph. Now, they don't recognize him. Maybe he's got a really good tan by then. I don't know what's going on. But they don't recognize him at this point. He grew out his hair, got a beard. They don't recognize him, but he knows who they are. So you've got this story where the brothers who threw you in a well, then sold you into slavery, are coming to ask for food. And you're the little brother sitting there. So what do you do? Well, there's a whole kind of back and forth, but what it does is it leads to a key moment in time. I'm going to reread a portion of what we read. It says, but Joseph replied, this is to his brothers. He says, don't be afraid of me. Am I God that I can punish you? You intended to harm me, but God intended it all for good. He brought me to this position so I could save the lives of many people. Notice he says, not many people, not just you, but many people. So what is he again doing? God is using these bad choices of the brothers, and he's blessing the family, and he's blessing the rest. He blesses Egypt, in a sense, because they have grain because of Joseph and his wisdom, who wouldn't have been there if his brothers hadn't sold him into slavery. Genesis is filled with stories like this, where people make bad choices, where God's plan could be thwarted. There's outside forces, there's famines, there's all kinds of things that go on. But all along, God is at work. God chooses a family. He chooses Abraham. And so he's beginning this redemption plan, this plan to save the world, this plan to restore things to the way they were be. And the family might fail, but God's plan won't. In spite of all the poor choices, God doesn't fire them. God doesn't discard them or find another one. God doesn't give up. He's faithful to his promises. No obstacles, no threats, he won't overcome. And this story, that last story, ends with Joseph's insight about this, that even though people sometimes choose the bad, God can take that and use it for good. And the moral of the story isn't we should simply choose whatever we want because God is going to fix it. But the story is God can use the mistakes we make. But we also notice at the end of the story, because if we read on in the story, Jacob then comes and follows them. And now the family is all where? In Egypt. Which should lead us to say, wait a minute. I thought they were supposed to be up in Canaan because that's the land God promised them. And it's about to get a whole lot worse, but that's a story for another week. That's coming next week. Because remember our casket, so we have creation, Abraham, Sinai, which is all the stories of Moses. That's going to be in the future. But so far, we've had creation, Abraham. We've seen a story of an unfaithful family and a faithful God. And as followers of Jesus, this is our family story. Remember what I said about genealogies? They're so important, but also that we tell family stories, and even when they're not the brightest. So I want us to notice genealogy. So in the book of Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, one of the four stories that tell about the life of Jesus begins with a genealogy, chapter 1 of Matthew. And again, most of us do what when we get to chapter 1? Go to chapter 2, right? Because Matthew 1 begins with this whole in the old King James, and so-and-so begat so-and-so, and so-and-so begat so. And it goes down the long line. But I want to highlight just a few of them. It begins Matthew chapter 1, verse 2. Abraham, we know who that guy is, right? Was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. We know this. And Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers. And Judah was one of the 10 brothers who sold Joseph off into slavery. We can also, there's a similar one in Luke. It does it a little bit differently. But so Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Judah. We're going to skip a whole bunch of names. And Jacob, different Jacob now, okay? We've gone a couple thousand years forward in the future. This is a different Jacob. Was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, and Mary gave birth to Jesus, who is called the Messiah. And then Matthew explains, he says, and those listed above include 14 generations from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the Babylonian exile, and 14 from the Babylonian exile to the Messiah. So just notice, we have Abraham, then David, who's a king. Remember our creation, Abraham, Sinai, kings. And then the exile shows up, and then 14 from the Babylonian exile to the Messiah. So we see it's this family line, that there's this story that continues. So the genealogy in Matthew and the genealogy in Luke and all those other genealogies connect us and remind us of that story way back in Genesis 3, where God says, and through your seed, I will crush the seed of the serpent. Through your seed, I will bring about redemption. And there's a hint of the one who will crush the head of the serpent, who is the Messiah. And so these genealogies help us say, like, how did that all fit together? Oh, yeah, this person was part of this family. And then they had children, and they had children. And the line continued on. And all through that line are people who fail time and time again. But what doesn't fail? God's promises. And Paul, one of the early followers of Jesus, puts it together this way. He says, and now you, he's speaking to the Christians, belong to Christ. You are the true children of Abraham. You are his heirs, and God's promise to Abraham belongs to you. And so what he says is that promise that God made to Abraham way back, where it looked like there was no hope, those promises are for us. The stories are all connected. Abraham, David, Jesus, and everything in between. That's one of the reasons we read these stories. Sometimes we say, why do I have to read my Old Testament? It's because it's our family story. As a church, as the people of Jesus, these are our family stories. And it's important to know our family stories and to see how Jesus fulfills them. And it's also to think about his promise of blessing, the people, place, and presence. And so one of the things we can recognize is, if we're part of that family, we're part of the family of Abraham. And he says, "All at the very end of the promise, and all the families on earth will be blessed through you." One of the implications is, if we're part of that family, we are to be a vehicle for God's blessing to the world. God intends to bless the world through us. And so one of the questions we might be asking ourselves is, how can we be a blessing to others? What ways can we, as individuals, as a congregation, as a church, be a blessing to others? And we do it in simple ways, with canned goods and with shoeboxes, with noisy offerings. But sometimes it's individual acts. It's going and showing up someplace, volunteering in different places. And it might not even be a church-related thing. Maybe it's reading to kids at school. Maybe it's cleaning up. Maybe it's helping to build a trail. Maybe it's whatever it is that God lays on your heart to make a difference. It's supporting community projects. It's getting involved in the life of our community. It's little acts of kindness. When you're in the store or when you're driving, and reminding yourselves, I'm a child of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob. I'm a child of David, and then eventually a child of Jesus, the King. And so I'm called to be a blessing to others. So does the way I drive serve as a blessing to others? Does the way I interact with the cashier at the store be a blessing to others? The way I treat my coworkers, the way I interact with other students, the way I interact with people online, am I serving as a blessing to others? We're also reminded as we read these stories that God uses people in spite of flaws. We see it in Genesis, and it's not just there, that God remains faithful and he doesn't give up. Now, does that mean we can do whatever we want? No, it doesn't mean that. But it's a reminder that God uses flawed people. In some sense, that's a redundant statement, isn't it? Flawed people, because all of us are flawed, right? But God uses flawed people. And one of the things we can do as a community then is say, can we be a community that mirrors God's inclusive family? God didn't kick people out of the family because they were screwed. When Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was, I mean, they were all had serious problems. But God didn't kick them out of the family. And so I think we're called as a church to be that same kind of family. That we don't look at someone and say, oh, you messed up. You're no good. You're not going to be helpful to what God is doing here because of X, Y, or Z. If God had done that, guess how big his family would have been? One, Jesus. But he doesn't. So what I think God is calling us as we read the story is to be a place where there's acceptance and encouragement in spite of imperfections. We're always encouraging people to be better. We're also encouraging them and saying, you know, I know that's not the way you want to do it. I know you failed in that thing, but God can still use you. Because sometimes there's that temptation to believe, because of this thing I did, because of this thing that was done to me, because of my failures, God can't use me. Read about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and everybody else after them. And God still uses them. God is faithful to bless even when we aren't. So let's encourage one another and help one another. Encourage one another to turn back to God even after the failure. And so these are our stories, our family story. But what I want us to remember, not simply that people are messed up, but instead the focus of the story is on God. And that God is the hero, that God is the faithful one. That his promises are fulfilled in Jesus, who is the faithful one. That when we fail, God is faithful. When we fail to be a blessing, God blesses us, even still. So may we keep our eyes on God, the one who is faithful, always and forever. Amen.